Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I'm joined by Raphael Baer and George Eaton to talk about universal credit and problems at the Department of Work and Pensions, while Caroline Crampton talks to Rachel Cook about the future of television, and I talk to Ian Steadman about the new film Gravity and what the best film about space really is. I'm joined by our political editor Raphael Baer and George Eaton, editor of The Staggers, to talk about the week in politics. George, you've written for you, I believe, quite a scolding blog this morning about Ian Duncan Smith in the wake of... So the Public Accounts Committee has looked into universal credit. First of all, tell me what the report says.
It doesn't actually tell us much that hasn't been said already, although it puts it probably stronger than anyone else has, led by... Margaret Hodgett says most of the £480 million of public money that's been spent on the project is going to have to be written off, that it's been terribly managed from the start, that they're actually going to miss the deadlines they've set themselves, the new deadlines, which already have already been set back by months, and that if they're going to meet the 2017 target, they're going to have to accelerate the process. But that poses new risks. I mean, if it doesn't work, people won't get their benefits on time. That's a new disaster.
And this comes back to a conversation we've had a couple of times, Raph, doesn't it, about this idea about Ian Duncan Smith and faith-based policy, the sort of belief that if you just believe in it hard enough...
Yes, the criticism that you hear from Ian Duncan Smith, from his civil servants... and from people who look at welfare policy independently and have tried to feed back some concerns to the department that the universal credit wouldn't work, and indeed from some sceptical conservatives, is that he sees the world in terms of people who are with him and against, and those who are against him. And the ones who are with him, it is quite literally an evangelical mission to use the welfare, to reform the welfare system in a compassionate, conservative way, which configured as making it more lucrative for people to work than to claim benefits. The problem is, while that's a sort of an admirable ambition if you're a conservative, it might be an admirable ambition if you're not a conservative, but if it doesn't work, and as George says, you waste all the money, at what point does Ian Duncan Smith, representing for the Conservatives this sort of crusading, moralising, compassionate conservatism, and the sort of symbolic utility he has for David Cameron in that respect, at what point does that start to be outweighed by the fact he plainly cannot run a massive spending department without ballsing everything up? And you feel that we might be reaching a bit of a tipping point on that one, but I think his job will be safe, largely because of that strange symbolic value he has.
But this isn't the only problem, is it? So they were trying to replace disability living allowance with the personal independence payment. That's gone. They've lost an appeal about the independent living fund, which is another disability benefits reform. What of his flagship reforms, what has happened? What exists?
Well, the benefit cap has been introduced, and it's inflicting a lot of hardship on the poor, a lot of hardship on people who live in London, can't find affordable housing. But the Tories would say it's hugely popular with the public. It's survived all the legal challenges to it. And in our view, it is saving some public money.
Let's remember the benefit cap, the politics of that have worked quite well. But that's George Osborne's strategic judgment that essentially you can put forward a fairly blunt message that says, look, the problem is the last government just hosed slightly idle people down with money, and it isn't really fair on the people who are just getting on, trying to work hard. The way you make work pay and the way you change the welfare system rather than really reforming it is by trying to cut taxes for people who are working and take away benefits from people who aren't. Now, you can argue the morality of that indefinitely. What seems to be the case is, politically, George Osborne has been entirely vindicated in the battle, ongoing tussle he's had with IDS, where Osborne has been saying, the halls of the DWP are strewn with the corpses of people who've thrown themselves at the welfare system with clever reforming strategies. It doesn't work. You just bring the bill down and then use the tax system to reward people, and politically and, you know, financially and the rest of it.
But that's the thing.
He's won that argument, basically, against
ideas. It's a very clear message. They say no one should have more than the average family earns. And, I mean, you wrote a blog at the time pointing out, well, what about people who've got, you know, 5 or 6 children? They can't magically have less children and therefore have lower benefit needs. My question is, where does Labour come back on this? Because actually they've gone along with a lot of this stuff. The Public Accounts Committee report says, well, we're all very committed to the idea of universal credit in practice. Does that therefore take the sting out of their attack?
There's an opportunity for Labour here, because the position that Labour had wanted to get into is to say that they've been on the defensive because they've been effectively attacked as throwing money, good money after bad, through the benefit system. What they would like to say is, no, we believe in reforming the welfare system, but we do it in a sort of compassionate way, consistent with our values. We don't just hand money out for nothing. Now, because IDS has sort of failed, there is an opportunity for Labour to say, no, we could deliver something, you know, along the lines of what he was trying to do, but because we, you know, our heart is in the right place, we're Labour, we sort of support the ambition, but we can take this mantle on and do it properly. As long as at the same time they make sure that there's a clear fiscal signal that by reform they don't just mean reverse the cuts. My sense is that so Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Work and Pension Secretary, is sort of working towards that kind of position, but hasn't yet found exactly the right language to say we believe in reform, we don't quibble with the sort of the moral dimension of what IDS said he was doing, but it's now been proved that he can't do it, so give us a go. That it's not impossible to imagine an effective Labour operator getting into that sort of space.
The question remains, why is IDS still in his job?
I think two reasons. I think the first reason is that they tried to move him back in the 2012 reshuffle. He was offered the justice brief. He made it clear that there was only one job he wanted to do in government. That was the reason he came back onto the front bench. I think Cameron and Osborne made the calculation that they couldn't afford to have a Eurosceptic right-winger sort of act as a rival centre of power on the back benches. The other reason, I think, is that because the rollout of universal credit has been so limited, very few people actually know it exists. There hasn't been, you can't in the way you can point to the NHS and say, you know, there's an A&E crisis. People say, yes, I had to wait this long for my appointment. You don't have people saying, well, yes, you introduced universal credit and now my tax credits are late. I can't afford to feed my children or heat my house. That hasn't happened. And so I think they've actually avoided a political car crash by just permanently and constantly delaying it.
He's
which means
by the pilot scheme, essentially, but not that 415 million or whatever it is.
Yes, I mean, there has been. Yeah, exactly. That is that's a great attack line for Labour, because they can say, look, here's a supposedly fiscally responsible government wasting public money. But you know, I don't think it's been, you know, anywhere near as much of a disaster as it could have been. The big failure is that Ian Duncan-Smith entered government in 2010, promising to transform the welfare system by the end of the parliament. You know, that ambition is now completely dead.
And just to finish, Raph, the general macroeconomic situation is looking a lot more healthy than it was, 6 months ago even. How are Labour gearing themselves up to deal with this idea of going into an election when things aren't utterly crap?
Well, they have two approaches. One is, as we've discussed before, trying to change the theme of the conversation on the economy away from what do the public finances look like and is the economy growing, because the public finances will be on a trajectory towards improvement and the economy will be growing at the time of an election, to say, what does the economy actually mean to you and your family and do you feel better off? And they're a bit more confident on that in terms of what the projections are in wages not keeping up still with growth and inflation. So they can credibly say, when it comes to can you pay your gas bill, can you afford your season ticket as a commuter, or all those similar issues, is this an economy that's actually doing for you what you need it to. And they're strong on that. The other side is they do know they still have to nail down that sort of charge of, or rebut that charge of fiscal laxity that they, and I don't think anyone in either Ed Miliband's or Ed Balls' office thinks they can achieve everything with the cost of living stuff, because people will say, yes, I know, I understand that maybe you feel sorry for me because I can't afford to pay my gas bill, but I don't really, that doesn't mean I'm going to hand the keys of the economy over to you if actually what you secretly want to do is just turn on the money taps again, because we know there's no money. That argument hasn't been won by Labour, and my understanding of it is that the thing that still keeps them up at night a little bit is how do we, what's the policy, what's the thing, the firework we set off, the emblem that we raise to say, no, we really do understand that it's your money and we can't just spend it whatever we want. And that's, they need to find that, but they do know they need to find that.
And on that note, I'll finish. Thank you very much, George and Raph. Rachel Cook, who is our TV critic, and every week in the magazine she reviews one or sometimes two programmes that have been on, and so is in a very good position to say what she thinks TV has been like in the last year, in recent months. So Rachel, is there anything that you'd like to pick out first off as being really good that you've loved?
Well, you know what, I always say the same thing when people say there's nothing on telly. I think that's rubbish, but you just have to be very selective. And I love telly, and so there is always, I always find something good to review, or at least something good to slag off. But and just because I slag something off doesn't mean that I didn't enjoy watching it, because in a weird, perverse way, I obviously did. and, so for me, most years are good years. I think this has been a slightly wonky year, in the sense that there's a certain, you can feel, really, ITV in the ascendant and the slight nervousness in the BBC. And what that has led to is some quite good drama on ITV, but drama which is probably overpraised because it's on ITV. Everyone's like, oh my God, this is, you know, actually worth watching. So I know everyone loved Broadchurch. I wasn't mad on it. I thought the performances were great, but I wasn't lost in it the way other people were. I think it was overpraised because it was on ITV.
That's definitely what I thought. Yeah. I wrote about it in the magazine at the time. Yeah. But from that perspective, you know, as someone who completely writes ITV off as somewhere where X Factor and football live, suddenly I had a reason to look at it. It was.
And I mean, the one thing I did like about it was that they didn't show it on consecutive nights, which is this other trend. So we've got a good drama, we'll show it three nights or five nights in a row. What they did was they showed it each week, and that did build the excitement. And I loved that, because I'm sort of, I suppose I long for the days when everyone was watching the same things and you could all talk about it. And it felt more like that. It felt like the 80s, really, the early 80s.
I thought the same, and I really agree with you about that, because I think they do that consecutive night thing because they think, well, everyone just watches it on demand now anyway, so let's try and at least capture some sense.
Yeah.
But actually, I think what Broadchurch showed was that the sort of new and old media can collide in a really good way, in that I liked watching it at its scheduled time.
Absolutely.
Because everyone else was doing that, and you could talk to them all on Twitter about it.
Yes, I think you're so right.
There was a kind of big couch in the sky
where
you could all talk about it.
I really hope that ITV have learnt from that, and that you know, the BBC as well, because it gives you something to look forward to, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
It punctuates your week. It's, you know, especially if you're at work all day long, it's nice to know that Thursday night or whenever is Broadchurch night. I mean, the other thing that they did with that was they kept it really secret. So no one knew who done it. And I mean, the other trend, which I'm really, makes me really annoyed, is increasingly long trails at the end of a programme for next week's you know, show. And I've just reviewed this new crime drama on BBC One called The Escape Artist. And the trails are so long on it that, you know, you pretty much know what's going to happen. And I just think that they need to stop that right now. So there's ITV slightly in the ascendant. There's the BBC a bit nervous and troubled. And so what you end up with on the BBC is a lot of Bake Off, MasterChef, Spring Watch Live, sort of bankable fairly cheap to make family viewing that just seems to go on and on and on and on.
And gets longer every year as well. Every time they bring it back, there's more of it.
I know. I mean, on Monday, I sat down to watch University Challenge thinking, phew, Bake Off is over. And there was a kind of post-Bake Off programme on about...
Oh, really?
I don't know, it was like the making of Bake Off or something. So they just spin it out. And, you know, at the moment, I suppose it's...
Tired of ads barging into your favourite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Paying dividends for them, but eventually that will be the golden goose that laid the golden egg. It will all go wrong because I think there are limits even for Paul Hollywood and Mary Berry. the other thing on the BBC is there's a lot of copycat. There are lots of dramas that you feel like you've seen them somewhere else. Mm. So, Ripper Street on the BBC was sort of connected to Whitechapel, even though Whitechapel's set now. Mm. This new one, The Escape Artist, it feels like a mashup of every legal drama you've seen before, mixed with every violent, murder thing you've seen before. I mean, that's the other thing. I think this has been a very bad year for TV involving crimes against women.
Definitely.
The Fall, which was on BBC Two, it had a marvellous performance at the heart of it from Gillian Anderson, who I just think is brilliant. But the substance of it was just so grim. It was basically porny. Mm. It was murder porn.
And even something as sort of cozy and anticipated as Downton has now got a rape in it.
I know.
Which, just given that was... I've never been a big fan of it, but I've always thought it was a kind of a bit like the Bake Off, a kind of bankable, bland thing,
safe
thing, and suddenly it's not anymore.
No.
You've got all of the kind of repression of the era it's set in, and so why throw some more horrors at
women? I mean, the thing about Downton is just how amazingly badly written it is now.
So badly
and
written.
And yet the ratings
keep going up.
Yeah, I mean, and I can only assume that because Homeland has gone completely wrong as well, people think, well, I'd rather have Downton going wrong, which has at least a comedy value, than Homeland going wrong, which is just boring and confusing and a bit like Dallas and Bobby waking up in the shower and finding out he's not dead. And I mean, that's just like Carrie now. Is she working for the CIA? Is she not? Who knows anymore? It's just a kind of fantasy. Whereas I suppose at least Downton, you know what you're getting, but it's so bad. I can't understand how it can be so badly written.
I know exactly. I don't know very much about how TV gets made in the sense that I know Julian Fellowes writes it and they keep commissioning it. But I was wondering, and it's hugely successful, has he got so successful to the point where no one tells him when it's bad?
I don't know.
Does he turn in scripts and they just go, okay then?
I think maybe it's had such a success in America. Mm. Maybe they just thought, well, actually, we don't need to, tell him not to do this and that because, we'll just go on being admired. I mean, I can't work it out. And there are so many anachronisms in it. People are on difficult journeys and out of their comfort zones and things that people just never used to say, and it just seems and then various things, we'll just put a black person in and we'll just and it's just ridiculous. So I think that's pretty bad. And then I'm really enjoying Breathless, which is a kind of Mad Men rip-off on ITV. I'm really enjoying it, but like I say, it feels a bit like the hour felt like a bit like Mad Men. So you feel that there's nothing madly original. The most original thing on at the moment, which I've written about already, but I really want people to watch it, is The Ambassadors with Mitchell and Webb. Because it's I haven't seen anything like it before. I mean, it is a sort of comedy, but it's also a drama. It presses all sorts of liberal, political, geopolitical buttons. It's incredibly well made and well written. And it seems to me that it really is original, because who wants to sympathise with diplomats who have such cushy lives?
Well, exactly. It's a sort of, I thought of it as a drama with jokes.
Yes.
In a strange kind of way, set in a fictional stan, sort of Tazbekistan or something.
Yeah, Tazbekistan.
But Sophie McBain, who's our features writer, her fiancé works in the diplomatic service, and he reports apparently there are lots of in-jokes.
Oh, really?
In it. So apparently, even down to the details, like they showed a brief shot in the first episode of a folder on the desk, and it had a number on it, and apparently this number is the number that's always assigned to no hope cases that you know you're never going to. So things like that. They've really
How interesting.
They've obviously got a consultant or something on the show who really knows his stuff. I mean, I'm sure that that's a joke that about 20 people in the entire country were laughing at.
Nevertheless, I mean, you feel that it's been made with real attention to detail, and it, you know, it does. It's kind. There's something quite merciless about it, and it. You know, it has a real satirical heart, and I really like it, and I want people to watch it. I also think if you are in search of originality, you basically have to go to documentaries, which are still, we still do better than the Americans. They might write dramas a bit more slickly than us, but I still think we do documentary better, more quirkily, in a less sensationalist way. And I have really been loving watching this crazy series called Iceland Foods, Life in the Freezer Cabinet. I mean, the title alone makes you want to watch it, because there is no life in a freezer cabinet.
It also sounds strangely like a sort of rip-off of a David Attenborough
program. Yes, it does.
You know, as if we're kind of venturing into the freezer cabinet or something.
And it's really good. And it's like all the best documentaries. It's a microcosm of Britain. So you're in this small world, which is the head office of Iceland Supermarkets, which this mad bloke started in the 70s with 30 quid and two freezers, and is now worth, it's got 800 shops and it has, you know, £1 billion turnovers. It tells you so much about modern Britain. It really, every politician should watch it, because it tells you about what life is like, you know, not in London, not even in Birmingham or Manchester, but in, you know, the small towns where life is a struggle. And it's not depressing. It's incredibly joyful, because Iceland, who knew, is one of the best companies to work at in Britain and is consistently voted that by its employees. But it's very cheerful, and it's funny, because, you know, there's a lot of comedy to be had in various of the Iceland products. But underneath all that, there's something incredibly real about it. You know, this is what Britain is. It's a small town where nothing stirs. There are no shops. All there is a branch of Iceland. Mm. And the people that go in it, you know, their lives are tough. And I think it's just really beautifully made and intelligent.
Well, we'll see what happens in the rest of the year. But thanks very much, Rachel.
I'm joined by our space correspondent, Ian Steadman, to talk about the new film Gravity. So I selflessly passed on my invitation for you to go and see it at a special top celeb screening last night in London.
Thank you so much.
First of all,
I enjoyed it massively.
So first of all, tell anyone who might not know, tell us what the film is.
It is the new film by Alfonso Cuarón, who did Children of Men, most famously. And it is quite simply about a hypothetical situation, which is actually quite possibly could happen, where a satellite orbiting the Earth breaks up and turns into a debris field, moving around the Earth at, as the film describes it, as fast as a speeding bullet train, which I had problems...
Faster, surely?
Faster, you'd think. My memory might be failing me. But this debris field goes around the Earth and hits into a space shuttle crew who's repairing the Hubble Space Telescope, destroys the space shuttle, and two astronauts are left with just a jetpack, and they have to make their way to the International Space Station, where hopefully they can catch a spacecraft that as a lifeboat down to Earth. But lots of stuff happens. There's twists and turns, and it's great. It's like I describe it as the towering inferno in space. It's just I was gripping the I you know, calling a film gripping sounds literal. It literally is gripping.
What's quite interesting is, so Ryan Gilbey's reviewed it in this week's magazine, and he's written about how unusual it is, because the film, it basically stars Sandra Bullock.
Yeah,
you get a little bit of George Clooney, even though he's given equal billing on the poster.
Yeah,
and a little bit of another guy, and that's pretty much it. But he said how rare it is to get a single shot, even just whether it's a movie or even if it's just literally, you know, the protagonist, the person whose face is most often on screen, for it to be a woman in her 40s is quite incredible. For that to be a sci-fi film is even rarer. I haven't seen that since, I guess, Alien being
it is. And there's a nod to Alien in that Sandra Bullock is dressed the same as Ripley with the vest and the shorts. And yeah, it's George Clooney's in it for about, you know, a third of it. And the film even does a nice little trick where it tricks you at one point into thinking that a man is going to save the day, and then there's a little twist and he doesn't. And it's quite nice that it plays on your expectations like that. I don't think that's too big a spoiler. Yeah. Sorry if it is.
Ruined it for everybody. We're getting letters now. It'll make a change for all the Russell Brand letters, so, you know, nice to have some other people. And I think what's really interesting is that the special effects have been lauded to high heaven, and they're already talking about them being a kind of... Is it right? It was a British studio.
It is. It's... Oh God, I can't remember the name. They're based in Soho, and they're brilliant. The physical effects of weightlessness are captured just so well. I mean, so much of the film is people dealing with the fact that stuff in zero gravity doesn't behave in the way you expect it to intuitively as creatures of land. A lot of things flying into each other and bouncing off, and sort of the. A lot of shots of people flying past stuff, desperately trying to grab hold and not being able to. It's scary. I advise seeing it in 3D, which I never thought I'd say as well.
That is true. Okay, so that's my two worries. So the first is 3D films, and the second is generally of a film when you hear people say the special effects are really amazing, that's code word for, and that's the only bit that's amazing.
Yeah.
So you said that you weren't a massive fan of the script.
I found the script... Well, that's purely because the film goes to... I describe it as like 90% scientifically accurate. And it clearly goes to a lot of effort to appear scientifically accurate in terms of the behaviour of objects and weightlessness and stuff like that. The design of the spaceships is
accurate. How did they film the weightless sections? Do you know?
It's all CGI. I guess it's on strings. For Apollo 13... Ron Howard actually took the actors up into the Vomit Comet, the plane that does the weightlessness. But that's about 11 to 15 seconds of weightlessness. And Alfonso Cuarón loves long tracking shots. I mean, 15-minute shots and things like that. So he can do that. So I think it's just all CGI with them on strings, which is clever, but works.
Yeah, that's incredible.
But the script kind of lets down the scientific accuracy because it's just astronauts talking to each other and with Houston down on the ground. And astronauts are extremely intelligent physicists, doctors, biologists. They are top scientists, generally. They know stuff, which makes it really weird why they explain things to each other like they're idiots. For instance, that debris field is moving like a speeding bullet train. George Clooney's character at one point has to explain to Sandra Bullock's character, who is the medical doctor on the mission, that she shouldn't breathe so heavily because it uses up more oxygen. Stuff like this. It's like it's ladled out for the viewer, which is, I guess, understandable because not everyone's going to understand space.
But very hard on the film wears exposition on this sleeve.
I just found the script very... It read just like not... It wasn't a realistic language use.
Okay, I'm going to make you rank it, and I'm going to, in terms of space films, better or worse than Moon?
I'd say better than Moon.
Okay.
Simply because it's more ambitious than Moon.
Better or worse than Sunshine?
I think. Better than Sunshine. Moon's better than Sunshine.
Okay. This is the ranking of where these things go. Better or worse than that one Doctor Who episode that was a bit like Sunshine?
Easily better than
with
that.
With the woman from EastEnders.
Yeah, it's not as good as 2001 A Space Odyssey, which also has excellent zero-G sort of physics in it, considering that was all like strings as well for the time.
I think I've run out of films in space. Alien is,
It's one of the best. It's not a science fiction film. It's a disaster film, but it's one of the best disaster films ever made.
Better or worse than the Doctor Who Christmas special with Kylie in?
No, nothing beats Kylie.
Right, yeah. Okay, on that note, I'll leave it. Thank you, Ian.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast. You can find us every week on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.